Welcome to the new Cyber Frontier, bringing you the latest news on the local Colorado economy and initiatives that focus on the development of cybersecurity economics. You don't have to be a computer or cybersecurity expert to get plugged in. Your host, Chris Gorog, brings it straightforward, asks the tough questions, and brings the cyber world to a level of understanding for everyone. Chris is personable and opens up with our guests on the issues we all would like to see addressed. You can find us on the web at www.newcyberfrontier.com. Now join our host as he introduces the topic for today's New Cyber Frontier.
Welcome to today's episode of New Cyber Frontier. Today we have a great show because it's of interest to me. We are talking to Molly Kuchelski, the director of the Rocky Mountain Regional United States Patent and Trademark Office, and also a 20-year patent attorney before she even got there. So welcome today, Molly. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited about this.
Yeah, I am too, because I am right in the trenches here, heat of the battle, working with some people to file IP protection. And I heard you speak at an event here in Colorado Springs for the National Cybersecurity Center. And I thought, you know, this is just awesome. We have a big student base of people that are working on new things, developing interesting things. So much cybersecurity, we'll say, entrepreneurship going on here in Colorado Springs. And we wanted to talk to you about what are the first steps. You know, so many people at the stage that I know I've been at are like, smack, where do we start? So First of all, give us a little bit about yourself. So kind of a background, how you got to where you're at. And we're going to be talking about cybersecurity, but you don't have to go there as a focus. I want to know about you, Molly.
Okay, so I started out as a chemical engineer, believe it or not. Every patent attorney in the United States has to have an engineering or scientific background before they can become a patent attorney. And then, of course, we're also, you know, gluttons for punishment, because on top of getting an engineering degree, then you go to law school and you get a law degree. And when I came out, I really wanted to do intellectual property. That was why I went to law school. It was why I was really interested in getting through the law school process so that I could be an intellectual property attorney. And when I got out, I went into a small firm, and I did all kinds of intellectual property. I did patents, copyrights, trade secrets, and trademarks. And I really enjoyed doing all of those things and all of the ancillary work that goes along with it, like licensing and agreements and contracts, and I even did litigation for a long time.
You know, that explains that explains something, because when I went looking for a patent attorney, there isn't very many of you guys out there. So it's all the training, and takes a special person to want an engineering degree and then a law degree.
The statistics are, we don't keep a super accurate count of how many people are actually registered patent attorneys that are still active at any one given time, but our best guess is that it's somewhere in between 45 and 55,000 people across the United States. So while it is a kind of a small band of brotherhood, it is also very easy for someone to find a patent attorney that knows their technology and knows their background. And so that's one of the things, right? When you're getting started, do your due diligence on who's going to represent you in protecting your intellectual property. Because, you know, at the end of the day, your intellectual property might be the only asset that's left in your corporation. And it might also be the foundation that launches your corporation and your business beyond what you ever thought possible. So it's really, really important to find the right person to help you. And, you know, there are people out there who unfortunately are not acting in your best interests. In fact, the Federal Trade Commission just got an injunction against World Patent Marketing in the Southern District of Florida for defrauding people and saying that they would help them prepare patent applications and then market and license their invention. And they had no intention of doing that. They were defrauding their customers. And the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office worked with the FTC to help, you know, submit evidence and prove that that was what was going on.
Interesting.
So that's my first piece. Yeah, that's the first step, right, for anybody, I think, when they're looking at, you know, okay, I have this great idea for business. I have this great, whatever it might be, right, whether it's a widget, whether it's a gadget, whether it's a software program. I have this great thing. What do I do next? And the first thing that you want to do is find someone to help you.
Okay. Well, let's take a break here from our sponsors. We'll be right back because I want to hear more about selecting somebody and also talk about what are the different types of IP. Be right back.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
All right, welcome back. We're talking to Molly Kuchowski, the director of the Rocky Mountain Regional United States Patent and Trademark Office. Molly, before the break, we were talking about selecting somebody to help you when you're at the point of your new business looking for, you know, what is the first step. And having done this recently is interesting because I'm in cybersecurity. And how would you... Because when I looked for patent attorneys, there wasn't very many of them. The choices weren't large. And I was looking, trying to find somebody local that I could work with, that I could see. Do you think it's better to pick somebody that might not be local, that is in the same area as your filing? Or what's your thoughts there?
You know, I mean, that's a business decision, and it has to do with your own comfort level. For a lot of people, they like to be, you know, they like to be in the same room when they're explaining their invention rather than trying to do it over, you know, some sort of video conferencing or over the telephone. With today's technology, I don't know that you really need to have someone in the room with you, although at some point early in the process, you probably do want to meet with them. But for me, paying to educate your patent attorney about your technology might not be the most cost-effective way to proceed. So if you can find somebody that already is in your technology area, you're already starting with a commonality, that basis of language and that basis of understanding that you can launch off of and hopefully realize some cost savings there.
Yeah. Other than just doing a Google search, is there a repository, a good place to say, here's the best patent attorneys, here's a ranking system, here's what they're specializing?
There isn't one repository. It really is a peeling back of the onion type of thing. But every patent attorney that is registered in the United States is listed on our database, which is www.uspto.gov. And if you type in the search box, Office of Enrollment and Discipline, you can do a search for any of the patent attorneys who are registered in the United States. And that's where I would start. And then for those people, you can look up their names on websites. And they, every single law firm lists their specialties, they list their degrees, they list the things that they've been involved in, and you can see who it is that's in your technology area.
That is a great reference.
I have to do that cross-referencing.
Yeah, I wish I'd have had that when I was looking. I was just on Google going, who do I pick here?
Huh? Yeah, I know. So, no, definitely start with us. And that's one of the other, I guess, pieces of information for anybody who is starting up a business, especially in the Colorado area, is that you have this Rocky Mountain Regional U.S. Patent and Trademark Office right here in your backyard. We're at 1961 Stout Street, and we're here to provide you with information and options. So give us a call, look us up. We have all kinds of publications and materials to kind of help you on that journey and get you started. And then we have all kinds of people here that you can bounce things off of. We don't provide advice, of course, and we don't provide free assistance for any of the people that work for the office, but we do provide information and options that you might want to consider.
Awesome. So on the information and options, let me know, let's start with, what are the different types of IP protection? What, is there a set number? I mean, I've looked into patents, trademarks, copyrights. Can you give us a rundown of what the different ones are and what areas they cover?
So there are four main buckets of intellectual property, and I call them tools because I prefer to think of intellectual property as a business tool. Mm-hmm. And the same way that you would create a fence around your garden, you want to pick the different tools. You can think of the intellectual property tools as your fence posts. And you're going to set them up at regular spaces around the garden that you want to protect. And then in between those fence posts, you're going to be using agreements, either employee agreements, non-disclosure agreements, but you can think of those agreements as the barbed wire in between the fence posts. And just like you would for a garden, right, that either changes size or shape or grows in different places, you're going to look at those fence posts not just once and consider it done, right? You're going to be looking at them to see, do they need updating? Have they been weathered enough that I need to replace them? Do I need to consider additional fence posts along the way so that I can protect my garden a little bit better? So for me, intellectual property is a portfolio type of thing, and it's definitely a business decision. But you want to be considering every form of intellectual property that you can. There are four main categories: patents, copyrights, trademarks, and trade secrets. Pretty much all of them have different flavors. For example, in trademark, there's trademark, service marks, and then trade dress. And then within patents, there's utility patents and plant patents and design patents. So, but the main categories, patents, trademarks, copyrights, and trade secrets are relatively settled. I think that's where everybody thinks about intellectual property as a whole.
Okay. So if I develop something and I'm a young person, I'm like, wow, you know, this is something I think I could protect. I could form a company around. You picked somebody that's going to support you. Now, if this is, do I start out with, say it's a software product, do I start out with a patent or a trade? What do I start out with there?
It would depend on what you're trying to do with your software product. And just in terms of, let me go back to one thing. So with the America Invents Act of 2011, there were a lot of changes to patent law in particular. Mm-hmm. But we established, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office established a pro bono patent program where you can get free help in writing your patent application. The group that manages that is out of Mikasa Resource Center here in Colorado. It's called ProboPat, and Jennifer Rothschild is the administrator of that. I can get you her contact information if you want to put that somewhere on your website to for people who are looking for that information, but you can also just type in ProboPat to one of your search engines and go from there.
Yeah, definitely. You can send me any links and I'll put them underneath the write-up when we release the show.
Perfect. So that's one option, right? And especially for students or people who we refer to them as under-resourced, you know, but who have that next great idea, we really want to support them because we recognize that people who start up small businesses create new jobs that didn't exist before. And, you know, for the U.S. economy to be strong and to be considered the foremost economy in the world, we need people creating new jobs. So we need small businesses. And we want to make sure that we're supporting them in whatever way we can. So the pro bono program came out of that. And then, you know, we'll use software as an example. There's multiple ways that you can protect a software program. If it's a game, trademarks might be particularly appropriate, especially with respect to if you have, you know, relatively unique characters. I hate to pick on Super Mario Brothers, but, right, you know, you definitely know Mario and Luigi. Those are trademarks. And then you might want to think about, you're definitely going to be thinking about copyright. You're also probably going to be thinking about trade secret in terms of being able to keep this, especially if you want to keep your code proprietary. You're going to think about trade secret and how much of your code can you lock away so that no one can get access to the source code. And you might even consider patents. It has become a little bit more difficult to get software patents following the 2014 CLS Bank versus Alice case, but it's not impossible, and the big guys are still doing it, and it behooves the small guys to at least take a look at that and figure out whether or not it's something that would work for them.
Yeah, that was something that, and that's why I asked about software, that I was confronted with. Do you look at a copyright or a patent, and what part of it and what differentiates when you have a software or a process within the software that is probably patentable? What are your thoughts on that?
I wouldn't think of them as either or.
Okay.
I would try and think of them in conjunction with each other. Right? Because so perhaps the overall functionality of your software program doesn't make enough technological changes in hardware to qualify for patent protection. But if you have particular modules that do, you might want to think about protecting the modules through patents. With copyright, you definitely want to consider how much of the program do I want to copyright? Am I going to copyright individual modules, or am I going to copyright the entire software program? But you can do them together. They're not mutually exclusive. The only two forms of intellectual property that are mutually exclusive are trade secrets and patents. So a patent is a right to exclude others from making, using, selling, offering for sale, or importing into the United States items that are covered by the claims of the patent. The quid pro quo for the government granting you a patent is that you explain to somebody how to make and use your invention. If you're explaining to somebody how to make and use your invention, it's really hard to keep it a secret. So that's why trade secret and patent are kind of those mutually exclusive thing. Although, right, they can exist in the same product sometimes. That has to be done very carefully. But other than that, I would never think of, just one form of intellectual property to protect anything that I was doing as a small business, because there are benefits to other forms of intellectual property that may not exist with respect to some of the others too. And I'll use an example. If you have a registered trademark, a federally registered trademark, there are lots of ways that you can utilize like Amazon and eBay and Facebook's takedown procedures. So you can get a product taken off of Amazon or Facebook, an infringing product, right? Mm-hmm. Taken off of Amazon, Facebook, or eBay, just by utilizing those companies' takedown procedures, you don't necessarily have to file a lawsuit. So there are benefits to each one of the forms of intellectual property, but at the end of the day, if you're defending your garden, if you're defending that space, you want as many fence posts as you possibly can have.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's take a break here from our sponsors. We'll be right back. Talk to Molly some more.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Over 3 million data breaches happen every single day. That's over 2,000 records being compromised every minute. So often, we focus on securing web data access. But what if the attackers are already inside, having gained direct access to your storage through data management software? When it comes to communications that go directly into your storage devices, make SNIA your first line of protection. SNIA's conformance testing limits outdated communications that are known to be used by attackers. It works continuously behind the background to make sure your storage is protected. To find out if your data is truly secure, visit our website at www.snia.org/cybertest.
All right, welcome back. We're talking to Molly Kachowski, the director of the Rocky Mountain Regional United States Patent and Trademark Office. Molly, I heard you talking about something that I wanted to kind of clarify. When you were talking about the difference between copyright and patent, you mentioned the hardware versus software difference. Is there something that says to get a patent or in that area, you have to have something physical happening or sell a product that's physical?
No, not necessarily. So there is a whole line of cases that started with the CLS Bank versus Alice case that concerns software that talks about what will be appropriate patentable subject matter. And some of it is relatively nuanced, some of it is relatively esoteric, but all of that information is actually on our website too. You can look at all of the cases. You can also look at all of the guidance that we give our examiners in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office in reviewing patent applications so that you understand, you know, what it is that you would need to claim and how you need to claim it in order to get a software application through the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office in order to obtain a patent. The biggest difference between patents and copyrights, though, lies at their fundamental core. So patent protects the functionality of a product, right, or the functionality of an idea. Copyright protects the expression of the idea. And I always use software as this example. If you have a software product that performs functions A, B, C, and D, right, and you write it in Java, and someone else has a copyright or a software program that has the same functionality, A, B, C, and D, but they write it in C++, without having access to your software program, they probably don't infringe because copyright protects only the expression of the idea. The other example that you can use, right, is for copyright is you and I can be standing, right, at the bottom of Pike's Peak, and we can see a mountain goat, and we can whip out our cameras at the exact same time and take the exact same picture, and we're standing right next to each other. Each one of us has a copyright in the photograph that we take, but you don't get the copyright. The copyright doesn't extend to any picture of that mountain goat at the, you know, on Pike's Peak.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so copyright protects the expression of the idea. Patent protects the functionality of the idea and actually how it works and how it interacts, especially with respect to a software program, how it would interact either with a, you know, general purpose computer or something else.
And that would be the A, B, C, and D process in a certain order.
Correct.
Within the software.
It could be in a certain order. You know, all of that would depend on how you were trying to claim your invention. You know, perhaps, you know, you need to do A before B, but you could do C or D whenever you want.
Okay.
But in order to get the result, you still have to perform A, B, C, and D. Mm-hmm. Maybe in that order, maybe not.
Now, what about the occasion? This is something that I was curious about. That I got a little clarification on, but I wanted to see what your thoughts are. The A, B, C, or, and D type of things, can they be things that are commonly done, everybody knows about them, everybody knows how to do them, but you've combined them in a certain order that now makes it unique as a process and you can patent it?
That is the classic example of something that would be patent subject eligible. You know, new uses for old things is definitely something that falls in the patentable subject matter area. But, you know, the one thing that you have to watch out for when you have all of the elements, so there are three requirements for patentability. One is usefulness, the second is novelty, and the third is non-obviousness. Usefulness, of course, is it useful? Does it do something? Because why would you want a patent on something that doesn't do anything? So that one's kind of a low hurdle. Patent subject matter eligibility falls in that usefulness area, so it's become a little bit more of a hurdle in the last, I want to say, 5 years. But next comes novelty, and that means has any one person done that, your invention before? It has to be one person, one reference, and they have to disclose all of the elements of your application. So in your example, if A, B, C, and D existed elsewhere, but they were all done by different people, novelty wouldn't be a problem for you.
Okay.
The problem would be that third requirement of non-obviousness. And non-obviousness, you can think of that as, is this enough of a technological advancement over everything that existed before? And everything that existed before is something that we patent attorneys call prior art. And so you've got this base of prior art, and is what you've done and how you've combined the things that existed before, is this a technological advancement enough to warrant a, you know, basically a 20-year monopoly on the things that you claim inside your patent? That's where a lot of people find that they have a difficult time overcoming those non-obvious rejections, because, you know, the examiner, as they are examining for these statutory requirements of patentability, they are able to take different references from different people and combine them, you know, so long as they have a motivation to combine those references. So there's a couple different things that are going on in the obviousness rejection or in the obviousness area, but it's basically that, is this enough of a technological advancement over everything that existed before to warrant giving you a patent?
Okay. So now on that line of thought, I actually filed a patent 2006, 2007, and there was, my attorney said that two companies dissented. It sounds like this is what they were complaining about, that it was something that was obvious that they thought shouldn't be able to be patented. So in this process, companies that already have something or already are in the market can decide, hey, I want to object to this party getting a patent, and obviously cause enough problems to have somebody change their mind whether they pursue it or not. That's kind of where we're talking about with this area here.
So the rejection comes from the examiner, right? So the examiner is an employee of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and it is their job. They are that gatekeeper for determining whether or not the patent application that is in front of them meets the statutory requirements for patentability in view of the prior art that they have found. There are mechanisms for companies to put prior art in front of the examiner, but ultimately, the decision of whether or not to use that prior art and whether or not it's applicable to the patent application that's in front of the examiner is the examiner's decision, possibly in connection with his or her supervisor, depending on their level of seniority. But it is definitively, like, the rejection doesn't come from a company in the patent process. It comes from a third party. It comes from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office.
Okay.
In the process of obtaining a patent.
Okay. Interesting.
Now, there are ways, like, if you're in the trademark process, there are ways, once the trademark examining attorney says that your trademark is allowable, they publish it in the Official Gazette, and other companies can protest the trademark, but that does not happen with a patent. The sole arbiter of whether or not a patent is allowable is the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office.
Okay.
Or a patent application is allowable. Yeah.
All right. So now, if what happens later on down the road, once you get or do not, you know, you go through the process, first of all, how long can we expect a process of any of these four areas to take?
So trade secrets are relatively easy to obtain and zero cost to obtain. The problem comes in the maintaining of the trade secret, because you have to keep it secret, so you have to take the steps both in your, you know, agreements that you enter into with the people who come into your shop, and especially with the people who you employ, either as a contractor or an employee. You've got to take a lot of steps to maintain that secret. So and you don't ever register your trade secret with anybody, because it has to remain secret. So, but there are a number of different steps that you have to take in order to maintain that trade secret. Copyright is relatively easy to obtain. I think it's $75 is the filing fee, and you obtain that through the Library of Congress. That's probably a 4 to 6 month process.
Okay.
Trademark is next up. That is $225 per international per goods or class of goods or services. And that process can take anywhere from 6 to 9 months, depending on how clean your trademark is. If it's arbitrary and fanciful so that the trademark examining attorney doesn't have any objections to it being registered for your goods and services, and there's no one else out there that is even close, it can be as speedy as 6 months, sometimes 9 months, depending on what the trademark examining attorney finds. What we find with people is that they select something that's descriptive or geographically descriptive or sometimes even generic, and those types of marks are inherently unprotectable. So that's where people get tripped up, because they want to name their product something so that a consumer will understand what it is right away. But if that's the understanding that the consumer has, then it can't act as a source indicator, and it can't be something unique showing that you're the purveyor of those goods or services. Mm-hmm. And then, so that's trademarks. And then moving on to patents, from your non-provisional patent application filing date, it can be anywhere from 14 to 16 to 18 months, depending on your technology, before you receive a first office action. Our goal is to get a first office action into the hands of, we have a 10-20 goal. I think that's a stretch goal for us, mm-hmm. But we try very hard to get an office action into the hands of the patent applicant as soon as possible. We're averaging right now, we actually tell you on our website what we average, and I think we're averaging about 16 months now. And then our goal is to have a final disposition on the patent application within 20 months. Again, I think that's a stretch goal. We're averaging closer to 30, 36.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think we could talk about this all day. We're coming up on kind of the time we usually allot for our show. But it's been some great information, Molly. And in kind of closing, is there anything other than, hey, don't be afraid to get involved, to get your IP patented, that you would put out to listeners, maybe even students per se?
I would definitely encourage people, come to us, talk to us. If you have an idea and you are confused about where to go next, please view the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, especially your Rocky Mountain Regional Office, as kind of that first line of defense. Come talk to us. You can set up an appointment, come into the office. If we happen to be in Colorado Springs, let us, we'll happen to be there, and hopefully we can set up meetings and those kinds of things. But we love talking to people about information and options, and we can hopefully get you some clarification on where you need to go.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Molly. This was definitely a good intro to help people get started and make those connections. Thanks for joining today.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate you having me.
All right. Bye. The views or opinions expressed during this podcast, not those of Colorado Technical University.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of New Cyber Frontier. Remember to get involved. Often we think that someone else will handle privacy and security in the virtual world, but you are the only one truly in command of your virtual fate. Join our mailing list so we can keep you informed of breaking news and new releases. If you have an idea, if you have a question that you would like to hear answered, or if you want to get involved with our efforts, reach out to us at newcyberfrontier.com. We also encourage you to visit our sponsors' links, as they are the ones that really make this show possible. I want to thank each of you for supporting the show, and we look forward to seeing you back for the next episode of New Cyber Frontier.